Hello, this is Father Gregory Pine, and welcome back to the Thomistic Institute podcast for a new installment of our off-campus conversations as I follow up with Thomistic Institute speakers near and far, wherever they are, whether that be following up on a topic that featured in a lecture that they gave, or maybe just having a conversation that will profit you, the listener, as a way by which better to live your life of faith, your life of prayer and study, as we seek to become the contemplatives whom God intends us to be. So for this installment, I'm very delighted to be joined by Professor Alexander Proust. Thanks so much for joining.
Thank you.
So many folks will know you from your many publications on a wide variety of themes, and from contributions that you've made at various Thomistic Institute chapters in the U.S. and beyond. But for those who don't know you, would you just say a word of introduction, who you are, where you're from, and maybe some of what you do?
So I am a philosopher at Baylor University. So I am a Catholic philosopher at a Protestant university, teaching there for about 16, 17 years. I have a PhD in math, a PhD in philosophy. I occasionally do things on the boundary of the two disciplines, but mostly I do philosophy.
Tremendous. Yeah, I recently had a conversation with Professor Frank Beckwith, and I am, you know, one of the many people enamored with the life of faith and study, which goes on there at Baylor University, because it's kind of, not that it's anomalous, like for people to be both believing and studying in the same place, but it's a cool setting because it's a Protestant university, but you have a lot of Catholic faculty and a lot of Catholic students or students who become Catholic in their time there. Like we've had conversations on the podcast with Scott Cleveland and Daniel DeHaan, who though he studied at the University of St. Thomas in Houston, he was often there at Baylor. So maybe, yeah, could you say a word about the intellectual life there at Baylor, some of the, you know, parts of the program or the culture which promote this kind of engagement?
Baylor is a very ecumenical school. It's when I was hired, I was told that the outlook is something like C.S. Lewis's Mere Christianity. So we're open to a variety of Christian denominations. The philosophy department is, how should I say, the graduate students have a very strong Christian community here. We have a weekly Bible study where we have all of us, well, not all of us, a number of us get together. Right now we're going through the Sermon on the Mount. It's rather nice to have people from different denominations sharing their views in a very open way and in a way very receptive to insights from others. And at the same time, there is a strong Catholic community on campus around the St. Peter's Catholic Student Center.
Yeah, that's awesome. I visited, I think, twice. Have I visited twice? I think that's right. Maybe in 2018 and then again in 2019, or maybe it was 19 and 20. I've forgotten the entire year of 2020, but nevertheless, I was there at one point for a lecture that Father Nicanor Austriaco gave, and then for a lecture that Professor Daniel DeHaan gave, both of which were excellent and well attended. But I was, the second time I was on a kind of visit tour amongst different TI campuses there in Texas. To call them TI campuses sounds so imperialistic, like they've become a TI campus. I mean, various campuses in Texas where there are TI chapters. And it was great just to see like the intellectual life there at Baylor, and how it kind of bleeds into the religious life or the worshipful life. So yeah, I was very encouraged by that, very edified by that. So I thought that maybe, you know, for this conversation, we could talk a little bit about the existence of God. We could answer the question whether he is before talking further about what he is or how he is not. And your vantage as a mathematician and a philosopher is an especially kind of incisive and insightful one, because I think part of the gifts, part of the gifts that you evince in your publications and in the way in which you address these subjects is a kind of gift of vision to impart to your listener, to your reader, a kind of gaze on reality. So I'm thinking of something that, that Father Lawrence Dewan repeated in his publications, that like metaphysics, you know, it's also a way of seeing. It's not just, you know, we talk about degrees of abstraction, what you leave behind and what you lay hold of, but it's a way of looking at reality. So in preparing maybe for a conversation about proofs for the existence of God, how would you, you know, maybe just thinking about an undergraduate student, how would you help him or her to confront maybe some ways that we look on reality which make it harder to get to this type of conclusion, to arrive at this type of conclusion, or certain habits of mind and heart that help us to facilitate this discourse, ways that help us to look on reality more honestly, more truthfully?
So if, when I ask myself what I've learned over more than half a lifetime of doing philosophy, there's a variety of, you know, specific points, specific arguments. This one works, this one doesn't. Here's a position that is false. Here's a position that seems true. But there's like one sort of overall thing that I've learned that sounds kind of shallow, but it's that reality is strange. And I think that opening one's heart to that is really important. At the latter part of the 19th century, there was this there was this feeling that science is getting us to a view of the world which is really clear. We understand it all, and then religion and all that stuff, and anything that's at all mysterious or strange, we can just dismiss. So reality is just a bunch of particles, hard little round things moving around, bouncing off each other, following the Newton's laws, all in determinate positions, and all falling deterministically from some initial set of conditions. A little bit of a mystery as to where these initial conditions come from. Yeah, but it's probably all existed forever anyway, many people thought. And so it seemed like we're going to get to this point where everything is understandable. And then scientifically in the 20th century, it all kind of collapsed. We found that time isn't absolute in the way people thought, and we have a very mysterious curved space-time that we live in, and we found that particles aren't those hard little easily understandable things, but they are things that behave like a wave, behave a bit like a particle. We can talk mathematically about how they behave, but what they really are, we have no idea. All we have is a math that describes their behavior, and we really don't know what is going on fundamentally, I think. And then eventually we found that our two fundamental physics theories, relativity and quantum mechanics, are probably not compatible with each other. And so we're pretty confident at least one of them's false, and quite possibly both of them. And I think a lot of the kind of scientific optimism that the world is so easily understandable and anything mysterious is just made up stuff, collapsed. And of course, in philosophy, we had this for a very long time. We could realize that reality is mysterious. I mean, constantly when you look at a philosophical problem, like say the ship of Theseus, you know, you've got a ship and you replace all the planks one by one, and you wonder, do you still have the same ship? What if you leave the, what if when you disassemble it, you put the planks all in a heap before you put the new ones back in? You can ask all sorts of questions. And one of the things that I think we found out as philosophers a very long time ago, maybe like 2000 and more years ago, is that for a number of these problems, you can logically list what all the possible options are. And you realize, wait, each of them has some problems. Each of them is in some way puzzling and mysterious. And so we're not going to get a straightforward, simple elegant answer to a number of these questions. There is something mysterious going on. Aristotle says that philosophy starts in wonder, and maybe this kind of sense of mysteriousness of the world is part of that wonder.
Okay, so perhaps thinking then about wonder, there are various ways in which to approach with wonder, or I suppose that there's a wide semantic range that wonder covers. So one can, you know, like I think of the person who wants to approach reality with a kind of spirit as of domination. So you can think of the individual who wishes that there were fewer things in the world or fewer things to know, so that way we could have a greater certainty or confidence regarding a higher percentage thereof. But then there's another person who approaches with a kind of wonder, which is an exhalation of despair, which is to say, like, ah, look at all this stuff. There's so much stuff. I can't even know the first thing because, what's the point if it's potentially infinite, or what's the point if it's so bewilderingly complicated? So not to say that like wonder falls between those two extremes, but wonder seems to transcend the limitations of both. Maybe could you just describe for us a little bit like what is the heart of wonder, or what is the soul of wonder, to speak, somewhat poetically?
I think you said it. That's very insightful. It does seem to fall between these two extremes, one of wanting to oversimplify reality in a way that produces a kind of illusion of understanding by closing one's eyes to the complexity of things, and the other being a despair that we can know nothing, and that in our time sometimes goes into a kind of relativism that denies that there's absolute truth, or some kind of pragmatism on which truth is what's useful to us. And wonder acknowledges that reality is mysterious. The mysterious always is something that kind of points beyond appearances. And so reality is something that points beyond the mere appearances, beyond what is immediately available to us. And at the same time, because it points, it gives hope, because there's something that it points towards, probably. And so we can try to follow that line of pointing and see where it leads. But at the same time, we don't have the illusion that once we get there, it will be all very, very simple and we'll fully encompass it with our minds.
Yeah. No, so maybe then to follow up on this notion of signs, or maybe more broadly, the idea that what we encounter bespeaks something further, you know, without becoming too mystical from the outset. There's the reality-based portion of that, I suppose, and then there's the subject-based portion of that. It seems like we're wired to seek explanations. What exactly accounts for that? You know, that's a big conversation. But it also seems like reality gives indication of a kind of coherence beyond. It's like, all right, this all holds together in some way, shape, or form. And there might be kind of absurdities which arise from the warp and woof of, you know, reality's tapestry. But whenever we pull on those threads, even if we can't come up with an explanation of everything or a final explanation for this particular thing, it's been the case, or it's been the experience of the human community, that we eventually arrive at something which, at the very least, is not inherently, intrinsically, or inescapably incoherent. So I love this word hope that you describe, or that you use to describe our, you know, laying hold of some reality and then our tending unto or reaching out towards what lies in the background or what lies at the foundation. Could you speak a little bit more to like how wonder ultimately kind of conducts us from present experiences to future, maybe that's to make it time bound, but from the kind of immediate experiences to a mediated experience of something that lies beyond?
I don't know that I can say much at this level of generality. It has been kind of my experience sometimes I think about a problem and I realize, okay, here's a tension, here's something that seems like a contradiction. And when I come to that point in thinking about a problem, it kind of gives me a bit of joy. Not a kind of, you could have a kind of malicious joy. Oh, reality is going to be nasty and messy. But no, I think that the kind of joy it gives me is thinking, okay, I've seen attention. And I think one of the things we've learned is that where there is attention, there is something deeper beyond what seems to us. And so we're getting closer to getting some kind of a deeper insight into this. I mean, sort of the ultimate kind of example of this, of course, in the history of Western thought, if that's been the right word here, is the unity of God and the Trinity of God, where, of course, the riches of so much of the Christian spiritual life flow from the initial apparent tension between these two things, which points to the very deepest of realities. And I suppose it's not surprising if one gets something similar happening when one looks at things that are created by this God who is one and three.
Yeah. Huh. That will be another episode entirely of Off-Campus Conversations. But at present, I'd like to follow up then on, okay, so you make various observations about reality and you pursue the kind of logic implicit within those observations in order to not merely formulate arguments, but so as to establish causal patterns or explanatory structures as a way by which better to account for what is. So I don't know much about proofs for the existence of God. I'm somewhat familiar with St. Thomas's Ways to God. And it seems like he starts with what's most evident to the senses. So he makes observations on the basis of, okay, things are moving, or things are somehow causally implicated, or things are, but they could be otherwise, or they could not be. So I don't know if it's accurate to describe it as him, making a judgment on the basis of his experience so much as him trying to account in part for the constitution of things as they are in the world. What do you find, maybe methodologically, or what do you find, apologetically, are the best ways to begin these types of conversations? Like, maybe what's most evidential, or what's most, apparent to the senses, or what are ways that, say, you meet a kind of random atheist on the street, and he says, I'm interested in learning something about proofs of the existence of God. Not that I think that I'll eventually assent, but just to kind of as a formal exercise, and you say, ooh, I want to get some existential skin in the game, so I'm going to start here. Where are places that you begin?
I think it depends on the person. So I think there's an interesting divide between the atheist on the street and the philosopher atheist. So my sense is that with the more philosophical atheist, I would actually want to start with something like norms and morality, because that I think is maybe in a way that's clearer, or it fits less well. It clearly fits poorly with an atheistic mindset. So maybe I would focus on morality and not so much the question of where it comes from, but the fact that morality is something that transcends scientific experience, and hence it's something that if we're to know about it, we cannot know about it through scientific means, and hence we need to have some extra scientific method of knowing, and that thinking about that might shake one out of a naturalist that closes one off to everything but the physical, and maybe ultimately points to God who speaks to us in our conscience. At this same time, the atheist on the street these days tends not to believe in an objective morality, tends to think that morality something relative, something we made up, and I think this starting point will not work as well. This is actually maybe surprising that contemporary philosophers who are by and large atheists, but by and large do believe in an objective morality, and the atheist on the street who tends to not do so. Maybe the atheist on the street might be actually a bit more consistent in this way. One approach I might use to get them to see beyond physical, I mean, this is something I think we learned from the church fathers, is that people have a really hard time just looking beyond the physical. And maybe before we ask the metaphysical questions, it just helps to push the mindset beyond the physical and realize, you know, there's more to reality than what meets the eye. And so what I might push on is, if not moral norms, norms of the conduct of the intellect. So the typical atheist, for example, idolizes science. But you can work with that. So you say, okay, so why should I listen to science? Presumably because science gives us access to reality that is based on evidence. But why should I believe on the basis of evidence? I mean, sometimes it's inconvenient to follow the evidence because it makes me feel in ways I don't like, because the evidence may point to conclusions I don't like. Why should I follow the evidence? Isn't there something that's objectively good and right about following evidence as such? And I think it shouldn't be hard to get someone to admit, yes, there has to be something objective about this norm that we should follow the evidence where it leads. But that norm is itself something mysterious, something that goes beyond physical reality. Physical reality is just what it is, it seems, at least if by physical we mean what physics studies. Physics doesn't say what should be done. But here we've said something about what should be done, what the human being should do. The human being should follow evidence. So the human being is just a messy bunch of particles. This is very strange. How could this messy bunch of particles have a should about it? Where does that should come from? So that, I think, might be a way of opening the atheist on the street to seeing that there is something more than the physical in reality. And then maybe for a more sophisticated one, mathematics might be another approach, because again, the typical atheist idolizes science. Modern science is based on mathematics in a large way. We need the mathematics to be objectively true. But mathematics is not about the physical. It's grounded in some reality that isn't just physical. So that might be the prolegomenon, might be something like, get someone to look beyond the physical. And once you realize there's something beyond the physical, then maybe you're open to asking questions and looking at answers to things like, you know, why is there anything physical at all? Why is there anything contingent at all? Why does the universe exist? And things like that. But if you're stuck in this mindset that everything is physical, that things that are not physical don't even make any sense, then I think these days people are often very content with saying, okay, yeah, there's the physical is all there is. It doesn't explain itself. There's just, yeah, so it just so happened. Things popped into existence out of nothing. That's how it is. And I think it's because you don't see any option for anything other than the physical in a serious kind of way. That's just think the rest, that's just fairy tale.
Yeah. It's interesting. In the argumentative strategies that you describe, you cite, you know, one that might be broadly conceived taken from ethics, one that might be broadly conceived taken from epistemology, one that might be broadly conceived taken from like anthropology. And it strikes me that all of those are relatively close to the individual's experience, you know, that lead him or her from what is better known or more immediate to what is less well known and less immediate, I suppose. But it's fascinating too. Like you also describe a kind of tendency among human beings to abstract further and further. Like I recently just read this last couplet of novels by Cormac McCarthy, The Crossing and Stella Maris. And it's all about physicists and mathematicians. And I guess Cormac McCarthy at the end of his life spent a lot of time with physicists and mathematicians. And you can see the allure. You can kind of sympathize with it because it just gets so darn, I mean, or maybe pretends to, not pretends in the pejorative way, but in the sense of like, it claims to give an explanation for everything at a certain remover, at a certain distance. So it's like, on the one hand, we need things that are close to us, that are close to our experience, that are better known, but we find ourselves like moving in the direction of an explanation for everything. But it's like we settle for an explanation for everything of a lower sort, or perhaps we wend our way in the wrong direction, or we, you know, kind of make an idol or find ourselves worshiping at an altar, which is not fit for, you know, human reverence. So is there, I don't know, I'm just trying to make sense of this. Is there a way in which like what we're doing in this type of argumentation, what we're doing with these types of proofs is helping people to move from what is closer to experience to what is less close to experience, but along a way that's actually, well, yeah, I mean, I'm question begging at this point. I suppose helping me to make sense of my own jumbled argumentation. What more can be said of this process of helping people to move from what is better known to what is less well known? Because it seems like it can go in any number of directions.
It can. And I think that's not surprising that it can go in any number of directions. I mean, the broad sweep is that we, you know, we would like to go from what's better known for us to what's better known in itself, according to Aristotle. But maybe I want to tweak this. I think maybe it's because we live in a more individualistic time, or maybe it's just something that Aristotle didn't quite reflect on. What is better known to an individual is individual. So for different people, you'll have different things that are better known. And that's why, you know, when I gave my little sketch earlier, I said, you know, it depends on who your atheist is, because there are some, especially among professional philosophers, who do believe in objective morality. But on the other hand, the typical, I think, atheist who is not a philosopher tends not to believe in objective morality. And starting with that, it's just completely pointless. You might work, some deep work and try to make them realize they actually maybe do believe in objective morality, even though they think they don't believe it, or maybe that they should believe it. But at least at first sight, they don't, even though it really is, I think, one of the very most evident things to humanity as such. But what's evident to humanity as such may not be evident to the individual human being. I mean, it's sort of, I guess, a general Aristotelian point, right? That like maybe what's good for the human being as such may not be good for you or me because of our particular deviations from the norm of the human being. So I think in terms of arguments that actually are going to work, I think there's probably a lot of personalization that is needed because the starting points with different individuals are so very different. Though, of course, there are patterns and the starting points due to a shared culture and also due to a shared humanity, of course.
Yeah. I think, so I recently had a conversation with Daniel Dehaan about Alistair McIntyre, and I'm thinking of the famous image that he uses at the beginning of After Virtue, where we're in this kind of post-apocalyptic wasteland and we're trying to cobble together knowledge claims as if they were coherent, when truth be told, it all lies in tatters. And, you know, like he uses that to describe, I guess at the time in 1981, he calls emotivism, but he updates his language subsequently. But this idea that people have these strong attachments of a subterranean sort, and that they're going to, quote-unquote, argue, that is to say, use a rationally kind of indexed smokescreen as a way by which to hold fast to what it is that they already believe or what they already think and feel. So it seems like a lot of the work in trying to have honest arguments with people is trying to get to that, and it's just the case that we're not going to be able to get to that in many instances. But we can also get to that. And certainly within the Christian setting, when I think about it in terms of holy preaching and holy teaching, there's a kind of healing dimension whereby some of those problems are addressed along the way. But how do you find like getting things on the table? To what degree or extent are we able to get things on the table? And if so, what are the means whereby, like, how can you host a conversation in a way in which the other person is better inclined to actually enter in rather than hold themselves off at arm's length?
I have to confess to having nothing much to say about this. I have just not been fortunate enough to have that kind of exposure. I find myself in an environment where almost everybody is Christian of some sort, and I don't actually have, I mean, occasionally at a conference, I have some conversation on a technical philosophy topic with someone who's not, but I haven't had that kind of evangelistic conversation. I feel a lot of what my contribution to that tends to be giving ideas and arguments to other people who are going to have these kinds of conversations. So training our graduate students who will go out in the world and teach at a broad variety of institutions, teaching our undergraduates who go out and have conversations with their friends who have various views and who are much more open to listening, to having a conversation with a friend than with a professor, doing perhaps the same thing with my children who are also going out into the world. I feel ashamed of the lack of such conversations on my part. I can count them on the fingers of one hand, I think. except maybe
I think you need feel no
one, shame. Or I can count the people I've had them with on the fingers of one hand. One of them I've had many conversations with.
Yeah. Like I said, I think you need feel no shame on account of the fact that, one, you live in a great place, right, in the intellectual environment of Baylor University, which now people will realize the degree to which it is, in fact, halcyon. And also, yeah, there are just like different, there are different roles to be played. Not that you need any convincing of this or pumping up in this regard, but people often ask me like, yeah, like, what do you do with, like, Protestant friends or atheist friends? And then I'll just tell them, I don't have any Protestant friends. I have one, but I don't really have any atheist friends. I might have one, too. But it's like, you know, you spend all your time with Catholics, and as a result of which, you're just going to have conversations with Catholics. But then again, there's always the internet. So when in doubt or when in search of a potentially fraught conversation, seek ye the comm box. Okay, well, kind of coming to the end, then, of our discussion apropos of the theme. A lot of this, you know, it's just kind of been set up, as it were, or in my case, throat clearing, what we would maybe call, you know, like heuristics, thinking about and being deliberate in our approach to the matter itself. But then maybe just directing our attention in these final minutes to the matter itself. Has there been, I know that you've published on this theme with some frequency and at some length, is there an argument right now that you especially like, or that you're especially interested by, or even bemused, bewildered by, a way to approach the existence of God that you're thinking about a lot recently?
Yes, it's so I'm writing a book on human nature, and it's human nature in the Aristotelian way as a non-material form that is found in every human being. The argument of the book is based on the idea that life is complicated, the normative life is complicated, and we have a vast number of norms of rationality and morality that we need to live by. And it's not looking to me like they are as unified as people like Kant and maybe even Aquinas thought they were. There's a thematic unity to them, but there isn't a kind of unity where you can derive the specific norms from the general norms using general arguments. So here's sort of an example I got from Aquinas. Is our Aquinas says, okay, look, you need to love your neighbor, and but you, there is an order of charity in the love of your neighbor. You need to love your parents more than you love strangers. And so if there is a choice between giving an equal benefit to a stranger and to your father, you should obviously give the benefit to your father. But then Aquinas says, but look, what if the benefit to your father is small and the benefit to your stranger, the stranger, is very large? What should you do then? Well, he says, then you should give the benefit to the stranger, because the stranger counts for something, and a minor good to your father is outweighed by that. And then he asks, okay, so where does the switchover happen? How much bigger does the benefit to the stranger have to be in order for it to override the special kind of duties you have to your father? And Aquinas says basically that there is no formula here, but you should do what the virtuous person would do. Namely, you need to attain virtue and then as a virtuous person judge it. And I think he's right. I mean, formula isn't his word, but that's kind of maybe our modern way of putting it. There isn't any simple mathematical formula. There isn't, I mean, we don't even have a good way of quantifying benefits. But there has to be a fact as to under what circumstances we have the switchover between benefiting the stranger and benefiting the father. It's a highly contextual kind of switchover. It depends on the specifics of one's relationship with one's father. Maybe how strange is the stranger to us? Depends maybe on the type of benefit and not just the magnitude of it. It's very complex. And at some point, thinking about ethics, I realized there are many such cases. There are many cases where we've got these highly complex questions. And I think we have no hope of coming to a simple principle from which one could purely logically derive the answer. And so I concluded that human nature has to contain norms of quite immense complexity to handle these kinds of things. These norms have a kind of unity to them. I mean, they fall under general headings. This one, you know, falls under headings of, you know, charity, of course, and sort of general vague preference for those who are closer to us. But at the same time, it has to be made much more precise, because morality has to be, in the end, giving us answers in specific circumstances. And then I identified that there's similar kinds of things happening all over in epistemology too, where you have these very complex, we have to have very complex norms. For example, you're getting evidence in science, and at what point do you say, now my theory is justified and I should accept it? How much evidence do you need? There's some sort of cutoff at which, below which, you say, I don't have reason to believe the theory. I just have reason to say, it's plausible, but I don't have reason to think it's true. At some point, you have to think it's true. Where's that cutoff come from? And as I think about the kinds of theories we have about how rationality works, I don't think there's any way of deriving that cutoff. And so I've come to the maybe somewhat unpleasant thought that our nature has to specify many, many parameters in the norms that govern us. And so it has to be very complex. And that points to something. It points, I think, to the idea that we're not going to get like a simple account of morality like Kant does, where you have one principle, maybe, or maybe three principles from which everything just purely logically derives. And we're not going to get the same in epistemology. Instead, we have a complex normative nature. It's not a physical thing, because we are not going to get anything like the answers to these questions from the physical. So there's a nature that we have that is not physical. And then And then where's, how's that get to point to God? Well, this nature isn't haphazard. Even though we have this vast number of norms governing our thinking and our behavior, they do fall under general types like love of neighbor, love of family, following of evidence. They're unified together. Being good rationally helps to make you better ethically. Being better ethically helps to make you better rationally. And there's a kind of way in which all of this, I think, points to a designer, but a designer of our very normative nature. And that isn't something that evolution can do, because this nature is not a physical fact about us. It's a non-physical fact, a normative fact. So this designer isn't evolution. It's surely not some kind of alien. I just don't see how, in fact, any finite being could design a nature for a thing, like setting up norms. Finite things can arrange matter a certain way, but I don't see how they can make the matter be such that it ought to behave a certain way. And so I think it points to God. And I also think there's this line of thought that I'm exploring here, that after Darwin, the only way you can be intellectually satisfied in believing in a human nature is if you think either God is in some way behind some of the evolutionary processes.
That's not intended as a mic drop, but it will become a mic drop as we bring the episode to a conclusion. So yeah, that's a beautiful thought with which to conclude, not beautiful in an aesthetic sense, but beautiful in the sense of like noble, fitting, that is to say, enshrined as it were, in a true good, because yeah, I think there's a way in which, you know, we think in time, not in that it's all history or genealogy, but in the sense that there's always a setting to the practitioner of the metaphysics. And like you said, there's going to be certain things that work for certain people and other things that work for other people, largely on account of the fact that, yeah, we're thinking things here in the 21st century, and as much as we might distance ourselves from world historical movements and cultural tendencies, they're still in the water, they're still in the air. So this idea of like salvaging human nature, it's fascinating that you can't unless you take on board other things, which might make a claim on your life. So thanks so much for having taken the time, and thanks so much for that beautiful explanation there with which you concluded.
All right, thank you.
And I know that you have a website at which many of your works can be found, alexanderpruss.com. But if people would like to follow up with you and with your work, are there other places where they might check in?
You can just email me. I get a fair amount of emails from random people all over the world. I don't promise to always respond quickly, and sometimes I forget eventually, but I generally try to respond.
Nice. That's super generous. So again, thank you. And then turning now to our listeners, thanks so much for having tuned into this episode of Off Campus Conversations. If you haven't yet, do subscribe to the Thomistic Institute podcast, whether on YouTube or on your podcast app. So that way you get updates when other good things come out. Unless, of course, it's time for you to pare back on your audio and or video content, upon which don't hesitate to unsubscribe, because it's for the contemplative life. That is to say, for a life of prayer and study, whereby we mount to the knowledge and love of God. So from all of us here at the Thomistic Institute, know of our prayers for you. Please pray for us, and we'll look forward to chatting with you next time on the podcast. Cheers.